The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
We are moving into a period of global chaos and disunity unlike any that we've had in the post-war era. How are you processing those decisions, risk mitigation decisions today, and also planning an exit strategy? Because, by the way, when gold reaches peaks, which I think could be over the next 3 to 5 years, you better have something of a reduction or exit strategy. If you're not mapping that out, you're missing a great opportunity.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Well, Dave, you called it. About 3 or 4 years ago, you were talking about what would be the next step as the central banks start stepping back from quantitative easing and low interest rates. The next step, of course, in the Keynesian model is fiscal spending. And I remember 3 or 4 years ago, you said what we'll probably see is either war. That's a good way to spend some money and pull the economy out. Or we'll see a massive public works spending project announced by the next presidency. Well, here we go. On Monday, that's exactly what we heard from Trump, the Keynesian model.
That's right. As Bill King likes to say, Keynes on steroid. Trump has gone Keynes on steroid. $4.4 trillion is the budget. $1.5 trillion is the public works scheme. And that's actually a pretty significant chunk of change.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, the one thing, you can borrow money, and you can borrow money, but you still have to find people to lend it to. So today, I'd like to unpack that a little bit later, Dave. I know the story on borrowing money a lot of times hinges on what happens to the U.S. dollar. I mean, if you're going to loan money to a country, you certainly don't want to loan money to a country from outside where you know that currency is going to fall.
Yeah, well, there's been this assumed advantage in the U.S. because we're the world's reserve currency status. People have to some degree, have dollars in their banks, in their banking system. And, you know, it gives us the opportunity to inflate away a part of our liabilities. Whether it's a 2% target inflation rate, consider yourself on the creditor side of the equation. If you've lent money to the United States and we're deliberately paying you back with cheaper and cheaper currency over time, 2% is the stated. Maybe we overshoot to 3 or 4. Maybe we fudge the number and are constantly inflating at 3 or 4%. We are taking advantage of our creditors. So some of the things to watch for 2018 as it unfolds. First and foremost, I think the U.S. dollar. And if the U.S. dollar continues to fall, as it did in 2017, right, there are significant implications for the funding of U.S. debt. And so again, we come back to, you know, we've got spending projects coming. We've got a tax deal in the works now. And, you know, that's one possibility is the dollar continues to fall just as it did in 2017. It'll affect the U.S. debt markets. It'll affect the equity markets here in the United States.
But if it continues to rise, Dave, doesn't that pull, I mean, talking about robbing Peter to pay Paul, it pulls money outside of this emerging market. I mean, look what happened this last week. As the stock market fell, it was the emerging markets that really continued to take the hit.
Now, when you say continues to rise, that would be sort of in the last week because the U.S. dollars had not much of a bounce here in 2017.
Right.
But if the U.S. dollar reversed course from 2017, where it was in free fall, begins to rise in earnest, you could see capital flows into the United States. That would be very supportive for our debt financing needs.
Right.
But as you mentioned, in turn, it would cripple the emerging markets because essentially what you have is savings flowing from overseas into the U.S. markets. In that case, you've got an emerging markets crisis, an unwind, and potentially a full-blown global credit crisis. That's something that Russell Napier talks about in recent comments. He's been a frequent commentary guest here at the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.
He wrote one of the best books either one of us have read, The Anatomy of the Bear.
If you're looking for an investment book, sort of a tome to have studied and be familiar with, I'd say The Anatomy of the Bear is a top 10 read. And he's concerned with this question today. Who is going to fund the U.S. government?
Well, and I know there's an active discussion between you and your dad right now as to the direction of the dollar and what that means for gold. Okay, there's a lot of conversation about the dollar. And I think there's an assumption, Dave, and I think the side that your dad might be taking too, is that if the dollar falls, that's really good for gold. I think what your point right now is, that really doesn't matter, does it?
Well, you know, if you say on a long-term basis, say on a 100-year basis, what is the stability of gold relative to fiat paper currencies? You could say, yes, we have a dollar problem, we have a euro problem, we have a yen problem, we have a British pound problem, because they're all fiat and they're all trading lower relative to gold over a long period of time. But just because that principle applies over the long term does not mean that it applies in the short run. As in, there's some sort of an axiomatic relationship. Dollar goes up, gold must go down, or right, vice versa. And, you know, a lot of conversation today around the dollar. I want to come back to that here in a minute. But I do want to mention something on gold, because I'm writing an article for my dad's newsletter on that topic. That's for next month's McIlvaney Intelligence Advisor. Make sure you call and get a copy of that. It's still a few weeks away before you could order it. But my dad argues, as you mentioned, that US dollar weakness is a prime driver of the gold market. And I would argue, as you suggested, that doesn't really matter. You've got supply and demand, which are in the near future the prime determinant of the metals and the direction of their price.
Well, we've seen foreign buyers. I mean, the foreign buyers have just been not only active, but record kind of activity, but not here in the United States necessarily.
Yeah, the next round of buying is likely to include a catalyst, that catalyst which will be inspirational for U.S. investors to join the party. So, and I mean, this is after 2 years. You investors have not yet come to the party. But as you mentioned, foreign demand has been increasing. Chinese demand for jewelry was up 10.4% in 2017. You think, well, does that really matter? I mean, gosh, who really cares about who's buying what from a jewelry store? Well, 694 tons was consumed for jewelry purposes in China. That's out of 1,089 tons, according to the China Gold Association, which came off the market in 2017.
And that doesn't really include the central bank buying. They keep that very, very secret. Hush, hush.
Exactly. Those figures are not included. Out of the 1,089, it's undisclosed what the Chinese Central Bank, the People's Bank of China, does. They don't disclose that for long, long stretches of time. But right now, there's more gold that's being imported into China, and that's likely to continue as Chinese production of gold fell last year for the first time in almost 20 years.
So you have increasing demand and decreasing supply.
Right. Supplies fell by 6% in 2017. And again, so that's China. Indian numbers, according to GFMS, a consultancy, increased 67% year over year from 2016 to 2017 in India. That was to a total of 855 tons for the year.
Well, and Dave, one of the things I love about the Indian buying is it shows just sort of who's buying and the instincts of mankind. I mean, rural buying. This isn't somebody who's manipulating the market or buying futures contracts. These are rural buyers for the majority of the buying.
Yeah, 2018 is expected to be a banner year for gold purchases in India, as you've got state funds at the federal level, but that are being lavished on rural areas. And lo and behold, politics is the same all over the world. Guess what's happening in 2019? You've got the general election, and so money is being tossed around. And as more money is lavished on those rural areas, it does find its way, good bit of it, into gold. Rural demand accounts for 2/3 of all gold demand in the country. So again, you're talking about people who are generally agrarian, and at the end of a harvest season, they've got money, and they don't necessarily want to put it in the banking system. They know what the rupee can do to them, not for them. That's a key thing to recognize. They are keenly aware of currency penalties. And so what do? They bank themselves in gold, and they do that in the form of jewelry and other things. But again, the agrarian culture, 2/3 of it rural, that's where 2/3 of the demand in the country is for gold.
Well, and you know, that's not to mention, going back to the central banks, the central banking demand. You know, there's three countries, actually four. There's China, Russia, Turkey, that we talk about large central bank buying. And then, of course, we include India in there. And like you mentioned, it's 2/3 rural demand. But those are the four countries that are really hitting the gold market. Now, the central banks in Turkey and Russia I mean, we should be paying attention to.
I was fascinated. It was about 2 years ago. Ken Rogoff wrote an interesting article. While on the one hand, he's arguing for a closing of the financial system and a forced inclusion into the banking system so that he and the likes of Michael Woodford and other academics can have what they want, which is their way with interest rates, taking them negative, completely negative, and forcing savers to abdicate not only the income that they would have received, but now actually a part of their principal too. Negative rates are yet one more iteration of theft from government extracting it from the people. But he wrote something a few years ago about central banks, particularly in the emerging markets, needing to acquire more gold. Mm-hmm. And I just thought it was fascinating because on the one hand, he's talking about sort of a closing of the financial system and, you know, individuals should not have cash. Individuals should not have gold. But on the other hand, central banks should have gold, and particularly the emerging markets, they should be diversifying their dollar holdings into gold. I just thought it was a fascinating commentary that goes back a couple of years ago.
Isn't that something we see from elitists all the time, though, Dave? You know, it's like Animal Farm, where all animals are created equal. There's only some that are more equal than others.
It's like Keynes being somewhat anti-free market, and yet he made his fortune trading grains. I mean, you know
several times.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So, yeah, you're right. The Turkish, the Russian, there's a number of other emerging market central banks which are active buyers of gold last year. So U.S. dollar strength and weakness, back to that point of contention perhaps with my dad and I, over the past 2 years, it has not kept gold in check or has pinned it down. It's been up. Gold has been up over 30% cumulatively over the last 2 years. So 2 years in a row. And guess what? The dollar was trending higher in 2016. That didn't put a halt to gold's rise.
Right.
And it trended lower in 2017, and gold did its own thing. So again, I see some independence there. The trend has shifted, and I think that other than what you see sort of from a daily knee-jerk response, you've got so many ADD traders, you know, attention deficit disorder traders who are saying, oh, what's going to happen now? You know, in the next 2 seconds, what's going to happen? You know, dollar's up. That means gold's down. They're overthinking it, I think. And the currency direction is not ultimately going to determine the next shift towards gold. Look at Europe as an example. Europe, I think, is a very good example. Last year, if you look at their currency, you've got great demand for gold in both Eastern and Western Europe. Coins, bars, ETFs, record per capita gold purchases occurred in Germany last year.
That's amazing.
The euro was up considerably. So it's not as if a currency, a critical world reserve currency, moves up and gold axiomatically moves down, whether it's the dollar or the euro or whatever else. Actually, gold demand, we're talking about the demand side of the equation here, was off the charts in Europe last year,
well, and
even
Germany.
With the euro going up.
And Germany in particular. I mean, this is a country that, you know, when Germany leads, the rest of Europe follows.
Yeah. So I think the critical driver is not currency. The critical driver of investor interest in the metals moving forward will be financial market stability or lack thereof.
Well, we talked about that last week. I mean, we had a VIX, a volatility index, that was unmovable for, you know, a year and a half, almost 2 years. So much so that people were placing their major bets on it never moving again. And of course, you said last week that some of those people were paid back 4 cents on the dollar when they had bet that there would be no volatility. So we have instability right now. Do you think possibly some money will start coming out of the equity markets on a worldwide basis and start buying something other than Bitcoin?
Absolutely. Global and domestic equity markets. So again, all over the world, including the United States, here domestically, we're going to see the equity markets drive a diversification into metals.
That hasn't really happened here in America yet, though, has it?
No, it hasn't. And you've got supplies of the metals, which remain reasonably tight overseas. You've got U.S. markets, ironically, which have been very weak, lots of liquidations of metals, not very much purchasing.
Right.
So in terms of gold demand and supplies, I think the supplies here in the United States are actually deceptively abundant.
Well, explain what you're talking about on deceptively abundant.
Yeah, I say deceptively because it's very little in terms of dollar volume, which would wipe out the existing supply overhang. Right. I mean, so we do have an overhang of supply, you know, bullion, American Eagle gold coins.
Right.
If you go to liquidate them today, they always sell at a premium over the spot price. But today they bid less than spot. that's the market dynamic today. It's something we've never seen in the U.S. wholesale market, but it's a circumstance which is very easily rectified with a few dollars flowing in. So again, you know, we're dealing with a deceptively abundant market where, yeah, today we have too many coins, but literally tomorrow and a few large purchases and they're all gone.
Well, let's just look at this company over the last couple of weeks. Drew has been domestically buying. Of course, Drew is a numismatist. And he called super excited on Friday that he was able to pick up, what was it, about 350 coins. Now, we're talking about the older coins, but 350 coins.
That's 350 a lot of coins, ounces. And it's no coins at all. Right. I mean, that's one purchase. I mean, if somebody wants to write a check for $400,000,
$500,000,
right. You know,
it's that's how scarce it is in a market that it feels like there's an overabundance.
Right. Now, I think rest of world buying has been strong, as I mentioned, as you talked about earlier. And I think there's a reason to believe with stock investors now having to validate their current valuation metrics in their equity portfolios, there's a reason for them to begin repositioning to lots of other assets.
Well, and historically, that would also be bonds. But what are you thinking about bonds?
Maybe. I mean, I think some flow will go there, but inflation winds are already blowing. And even if it's just the concern or the expectation more than the actual inflation gauges rumbling, you've also got rates, which are already on the rise. So if the rate trend in terms of rising instead of falling is a secular trend in nature, then you have investors that have not seen a real secular bond bear market in over 37 years.
Well, in definitions here, I mean, cyclical is the shorter and then secular is the longer. And you've made it a point to say that usually interest rates travel in 30 to 35 year patterns. They go up for about that time and then they go back down that time.
The shortest interest rate trend in the United States in 200 years plus of U.S. interest rate history is 22 years. The longest is about 37, and we've seen 37 twice. So the average is probably closer to 26 to 28, but again, that's an average.
So if Bill Gross is correct, and now that we've topped 2.66 on the 10-year treasury and actually pushed close to 3, we're now probably reversing that trend and interest rates will be rising now for what, 30 years?
So the question is, even if it's 10 years,
right?
I mean, we don't know the future beyond tomorrow. So, you know, we don't know with certainty. But one thing that makes sense is if there's a reason for concern in the bond market, then the typical allocation out of stocks and into bonds may cause at least some of the flow to go into metals. And in the metals market, I would bet on short-term weakness in the price. Look, you've got the plunge protection team, which is trying to stabilize the stock market, trying to buoy back sentiment and say, hey, look, no, this was a technical glitch. It was a VIX short trade, nothing more. Keep on moving. The economy's fine. We're doing everything that we can. But starting post-summer, I think we're likely to see the gold price move past the 1400 barrier and into the price range that grabs people's attention and signals a secular shift there. I think we're already in that shift. You know, we bottomed at 1050. We're up $300 from that level. 2019, if you're looking for a great year, 2019 is my bet for a record year in the metals. That might coincide with an emergent U.S. recession, 2019 to 2020, and we may be in the middle of an equity bear market. It's anyone's guess, but I would hedge and invest accordingly.
You know, I want to go back to what we were talking about, Trump announcing a $4.4 trillion budget and, you know, increasing by $1.5 trillion just with spending projects. You know, the concern is our deficits are set to rise considerably. I mean, everyone would admit that. And yes, they say, well, tax cuts will put a lot of that money back into the coffer. But, you know, actually, the government spending has to be paid for.
Well, the assumption is that tax cuts are neutral. And the only reason they're considered neutral is because the, let's call it pie in the sky thinking, until it's happened, it's pie in the sky. It's hopeful thinking. And it may turn out to be true, but right now, it's just hopeful thinking that you cut taxes and it's going to stimulate growth in the economy such that there is a net benefit, and that net benefit will more than compensate for an increase in debt.
In a way that's counting chickens before they're hatched.
Well, that's true. Yeah. That's true. And it's patting yourself on the back long before you've accomplished anything. And I go back to Napier's question of who will fund the U.S. government. Who will fund the U.S. government is a particularly big deal coming into 2018 because you've got three things floating, which are a real concern. our deficits are rising considerably. Yes, we have tax cuts, and that is an increase in government spending meeting up at the same time. So, you know, compared to 2017, we had our deficit numbers of roughly $500 billion. Now we'll have nearly $1 trillion in deficit spending for 2018. So we're up by close to 100% in terms of our deficit spending for 2018. On top of that, second area of concern is that the Fed is on tap to reduce its holdings. We talked about this last week, including treasuries, by nearly $500 trillion, which will have to be absorbed by someone's savings. Mm-hmm. So add an extra $400 to $500 billion from that source to the supply of treasuries. And then there's the third point of concern, which is there have been liquidations of treasuries in recent years. If you're looking at treasury flows, Dave Burgess does this for us at our wealth management team, as does Doug Noland, who manages the tactical short. And, you know, in recent years, we have seen net liquidations of treasuries. That adds to potential supply overhang. But on that third point, it's worth noting that the central bank community has done a great deal to mask the erosion of interest in U.S. government bonds. So even though we've seen, in terms of treasury flows between foreign central banks, a net outflow, the significant shift taking place right now is that central banks are normalizing their monetary policies. They're stepping away from the markets. They're allowing supply and demand factors to normalize somewhat. That's both in Europe and the United States. And the foreign central banks who were your chief buyers of bonds, now all of a sudden their net liquidations are going to become far more obvious.
Okay, so let me repeat this back to you so I understand. The three things that you're talking about, our deficits are set to pretty much double. Okay.
To $1 trillion.
Yeah. And the Fed is now at the same time, who had been the buyer of last resort and first resort, the Fed is backing away and saying, we're not going to be buying as many. And the general public, or whatever the rest of the market is, we've been seeing diminished interest in that for the last year or two. So who's going to be doing the buying of these bonds?
That's right. If it's not the central banks, if they have a diminished interest in treasuries, if it's not our own central bank, the Fed, which they've said they're moving away from the treasury market as a buyer of both first and last resort, where are the savings going to come from, which support our budget deficit financing needs? Because see, again, you're talking about $1.5 trillion, old debt, which has to be handed over to someone, plus another $1 trillion in debt for 2018. That money has to be borrowed from someone. Right. In order to spend it, right? So someone's savings have to come into play. Someone has to lend the money. We have the petrodollar recycling of an earlier generation. It's largely over. We have the Chinese trade surplus dollar recycling, which is coming to an end. And the mirage of financial and economic functionality, which is created by the Fed's presence in the market, that's what we've had since the global financial crisis. That mirage is coming to an end. None of this would be a concern if not for the massive deficits in play.
Right. And I think we need to go back and look at that, because if we were on a gold standard and had to settle our accounts with gold,
it wouldn't be a possibility.
We wouldn't have this. So why don't we just walk through what has supported the dollar for the last 40 or 50 years? Because, you know, when I was a kid, we were on a gold standard. Okay. And then we basically moved off of the gold standard, reneged on that, the Bretton Woods system, and said, well, yes, but we're going to use the dollar for oil. That was the petrodollar standard. That's changing, but we added the Chinese. Okay, the Chinese, we bought $400 extra billion worth of their stuff. Yeah, and they turned around and loaned it back to us. Now, as the Chinese faded away after the financial crisis, we had the central bank buying. So we started with gold, then we went to petrodollar, then we went to the Chinese, then we went to the Fed. Now, the Fed's backing away. I'm starting to feel like Wile E. Coyote, you know, about 3 feet off the cliff looking down. I haven't fallen yet, but it's like, who's going to buy?
Who's going to buy? That's right. And there's two sources of savings, domestic private savings, mine, yours, or foreign private savings. Right. So again, you're talking about private investors who, for one reason or another, want to own treasuries.
How do you attract that?
I think a massive shift from stocks to bonds, including an interest in treasuries. If you could intrigue your asset managers around the world, there would be sufficient quantities of money to finance our deficits. Of course, that pulls the rug out from under the stock market.
Right, robbing Peter again to pay Paul.
Yeah, so it's just a shift in priorities. Do you want the wealth effect where everyone feels happier, but there's greater political contentions between the rich and the poor? Or do you begin to see a leveling, a leveling of the rich and poor where reallocation occurs primarily through market chaos and catastrophe? Because again, if you are inspiring, quote unquote, the saver to take his money out of stocks and put it into bonds, it has to be because A, there's no upside in stocks, or B, there's terror and only downside in stocks. So again, that is an, let's call it an emergent pressure. It's been revealed in the last 10 days with the U.S. stock market selling off 10% in a week from Friday through Friday, so actually a 6 days of trading.
Well, and the rise in interest rates, wouldn't that be the carrot on the stick? I mean, if the dollar is strong and you have a rise in interest rates, like you're talking about, that would also be a reason to move from equities.
Oh, well, sure. And I mean, I think that's also just a question of interest rate differentials. On a relative basis, interest rates in the U.S. Treasury market would be more attractive, and that would be, I think, inspirational to your foreign investor, encouraging private savings from foreign sources to come into the U.S. dollar and into the U.S. Treasury market.
Okay, now I'm going to get conspiratorial just for a little while, because you have studied sort of the foreign politics and the diplomacy that's used with the U.S. Treasury and the U.S. dollar and the control of the SWIFT system and some of the things that we've seen, you know, with countries like Iran, putting pressure on Iran or putting pressure on Russia. I mean, is it to the advantage of the United States, who needs foreign buyers of staple treasuries, to actually maybe allow a little bit of worldwide chaos when you can encourage it?
In terms of U.S. foreign policy, it's intriguing that, yeah, I think global chaos does underscore U.S. dollar strength, and it supports our Treasury Department's financing needs as money from other non-domestic sources seek a safe haven. So, I mean, just linger on that for a minute. Global chaos arguably is here to stay. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know of anyone who's still in the camp of we're on the verge of the singularity, or we're on the verge of a world of peace and prosperity for everyone. Global chaos arguably is here to stay. That feeds U.S. dollar strength and encourages flows into U.S. treasuries. So I'm just giving you a case. One reason why you could see interest rates move lower and you could see the continuation of a bond bull market in spite of the current price action, if there is enough global chaos and people say, we have to get out of Dodge, where would you rather be, Venezuela or the U.S. dollar?
If we go back and look historically at global politics, a big part of diplomacy and politics is actually creating a little bit of chaos with, maybe it's not your enemy, maybe it's your ally, but creating a situation that would give yourself a positive boost while pulling from another country.
The year that I spent at Oxford, I learned something about the British when I practiced snooker. Snooker is like a billiards table, only it's a 12-foot long table, and you have a lot more small, multicolored balls on the table. And it's both a game of offense and defense. And you can score points both by sinking a ball, which would be sort of positive for you, but you can also score points by creating conundrums for your opponent.
Frustrating the opponent.
Yeah. If he cannot make a shot, you can earn points on the basis of putting him in a terrible position.
Does that sound like British foreign policy?
Oh,
say in India,
absolutely.
The opium wars,
exactly.
Or Chinese, rather?
Exactly. I thought this is a game that absolutely belongs to the British.
Yeah.
Now, so if you were the Treasury Department, the U.S. Treasury Department today, would you be inclined to stir the pot? That's a phrase that my son, who's soon to be 4 years old, he loves to use. I'll ask him what was going on when there is a conflict with one of his siblings. And he always says, so-and-so was turring the pot.
Turring the pot. Yeah, he's
so-and-so
four.
Was turring the pot.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so if you had a country that you knew flows of currency would come into U.S. treasuries that was maybe teetering, that was maybe, you know, on the edge of instability, and you were the U.S. Treasury, you had the ability to do that, like we did with Iran, I guess you'd be inclined to do that, wouldn't you?
If anyone was teetering, might you give a little extra shove if you were the Treasury? I don't know. I mean, we've explored the idea, which Juan Zarate popularized in his book Treasury Wars, where today U.S. foreign policy is implemented as much or more by the Treasury Department than the State Department. So State Department diplomats, by and large, pose for pictures and they pretend to be the voice piece for U.S. interests. They diplomatically deliver the current party line at cocktail parties all over the world. It's a tough job. Wine and cheese and all that. I mean, it's a little different if you're Hillary Clinton. Then the job becomes more complex, but that's maybe just a server issue.
Well, and you wonder, okay, I mean, if we were to sit and try to be ethical or moral about this, you'd say, well, gosh, you know, this is sort of a war without blood. I mean, is this a money buys everything or a money buys influence type of question?
That's the point. The Treasury is engaging in a new form of warfare. They can cut off funding to terrorism. They can implement sanctions. The Treasury Department can.
Right.
Treasury limits access to SWIFT. Treasury uses the flows of capital or the lack of it to buttress our foreign policy objectives in real ways, in support of some regimes and to tear down others. So the U.S. dollar rising, which that's not a given. That's not a given.
Right.
But if the U.S. dollar is rising, and that's what is at least proposed by our friend Russell Napier, what does it do? One of the things it does is it impedes global growth. It strangles emerging market equities. And as there's chaos caused by the strangulation in the emerging market equity space, you do have traffic coming into safe haven assets. Mm-hmm. And by the way, if the yield differential on U.S. Treasuries is still positive, why wouldn't you move into U.S. Treasuries and into a currency which is appreciating as well? And I, you know, look, I don't think Napier is taking sort of the Machiavellian view that perhaps you and I have just discussed, where U.S. Treasury is involved in foreign affairs. I do tend to see that. But again, that's influenced by reading Zarate, who's not a wild-eyed guy with an opinion about what the Treasury Department is doing. He is a Treasury guy.
Well, and if you were to look at relative stability, and we, let's say, look at the last week and a half, yes, we had instability in our equities market, but boy, did they have equity instability worldwide.
Yeah. I mean, back to the emerging markets. If that's your focus, that in the U.S., we sold off last week, Monday through Friday, 5.2%. The S&P last week ended down 5.2%. The Shanghai Composite was down 9.6.
Yeah, almost double.
Hong Kong down 9.5. The Nikkei, Japan's Nikkei 225 was down 8.1%. Germany, the DAX was on par with the US. It was down 5.3. The French market, the CAC was down 5.3%. The KOSPI there in South Korea was down 6.4%. That was in the red, and Taiwan was off 7.8%. I mean, so you're talking about good degrees of pain in a short period of time here in the U.S., but a lot more pain in other places.
Yes.
If that continues, you're going to end up redirecting capital flows, and I think some of it may come back to dollars.
So does that answer Napier's question on who is going to fund this now doubling or burgeoning deficit?
It just depends. I mean, could it be that the more severe hemorrhaging in the emerging markets and overseas developed markets feeds the necessary savings flows into safe haven assets like U.S. Treasuries? The flow from overseas would certainly buttress U.S. dollar strength and take away one of the two concerns a foreign investor has when moving money around. Just like so much jello on a global plate, you've got to look at the asset that you want to own, U.S. fixed income. But then you've got to ask the question, do you want dollar exposure, right? Because exchange rate volatility can kill you, or it can add to your returns. Look at this last year. To buy U.S. Treasuries was a double loser in 2017. Why? Well, I should say actually early 2018, because that's where most of the volatility has occurred. Rates are on the rise, and the dollar's not necessarily helping you. Bond market has been a tough go, let's say over the last 6 to 8 months.
Well, just to simplify, because I, as a U.S. investor, you know, I don't want to see the dollar sink necessarily, but it doesn't really affect me. If I go and buy with U.S. dollars here in the United States, a U.S. Treasury, and the dollar falls, well, I'm still using dollars, I'm paying back in dollars, I'm getting paid in dollars. But if you're a foreigner anywhere else, and you're loaning the U.S. government money, let's say the dollar, like you said, the dollar fell 11% last year. Let's say you were making 3% on that money. You're still down 8%, not including inflation.
That's right. So, yeah, the direction of the dollar is critical, to Napier's point, if deficit funding is going to be sourced from overseas. That's the deal. It has to be an attractive proposition, and you will see. Or if money is fleeing from something that is unattractive, then those flows will catalyze an increase in the dollar, and that will feed on itself as an increasing dollar attracts more money into an increasing dollar trade. In 2017, the currency issue did not advertise U.S. dollar assets very well. The U.S. dollar sank by 11%, you mentioned. And in certain currency terms, if you're comparing it to the euro, it was closer to 16%. So, I mean, nasty year for the US dollar if you're a foreign investor. So imagine if you're considering shifting assets around as an international investor. Is the US dollar a value at this point after last year's sell-off? Maybe.
Right.
But relative to what? Relative to what? Now in 2018, you have rates rising, bond prices falling, which also does not, at this point, advertise U.S. treasuries as the best way for foreigners to preserve capital.
At least not long treasuries, right?
Correct. But suppose the U.S. dollar catches a significant bid, begins to move back towards, let's say, 100 compared to the euro index. Yield is more attractive for an overseas investor, certainly if you're in Europe or in Japan. Would you best be compensated with maturities of 2 years, 5 years, 10-year paper? Probably. You mentioned it at the beginning of the program, 2.85%. That's up 45 basis points year to date. That's for your 10-year. If you go to the 30-year treasury, you go from 2.85 on the 10 to 3.16 on the 30. That's your flat yield curve.
So if you're a foreigner listening to this program and you're thinking that possibly this is going to happen, that interest rates are going to rise, if you're going to buy, you want to buy the short end.
Buy the short end of the curve and limit your inflation risk. On the extra 20-year period, you only gain 30-ish basis points for an extra 20 years of inflation exposure. No way.
Right.
No way. But should the dollar rise, you have to remember that there are huge amounts of U.S. dollar denominated debt, which have been issued in foreign markets since the global financial crisis. And this is where you've got the potential for a massive credit meltdown, a credit crisis in the emerging markets, starting in the emerging markets, because of the classic currency mismatch. The source of almost every emerging market bond blowout has come from an emerging market borrowing in foreign currency terms as they depreciate their currency. And if our currency appreciates, the hurdle to pay back that debt gets higher and higher and higher, increasing the likelihood of, yes, you're thinking it, default.
Okay.
That's a failure in the bond market, a credit crisis.
And really, we've been conditioned for the last 10 years. I mean, you mentioned the global financial crisis, but it's been 10 years now since the global financial crisis, 2008. We're used to everything happening gradually, so much so that we got used to just betting on pure consistency of the volatility index. Now, when confidence changes, we saw last week how quickly you can go from a dollar's worth of value to 4 cents worth of value if you're betting against volatility. I mean, if that confidence breaks, could it suddenly do the same thing to the bond market?
Right. And that confidence could be based on international conflict or some harebrained tweet that goes out from the president, or, you know, who knows what it is, but there are certain confidence issues implicit to the U.S. financial markets, which could radically impair the treasury markets too. So again, sort of a trickle out of U.S. treasuries on a net basis, which we are seeing, and we've already said has been masked by central bank interventionism. Could that trickle, under the right circumstances, become a flood where investors are exiting the treasury market, where rates have been rising gradually at first, as they are now, and then have their own version of the VIX moonshot? The VIX, the volatility index, went from 14 to 50 in a day. And yet we pretended for a long time like a sub 10 number, a single digit number on the VIX was normal. It was the new normal because there was no risk in the market. Of course, there's no risk in the market. We know that. We're 21st century men. We understand.
Okay. So I'm Trump and I'm starting to look toward the next election. And I look at who elected me before, the populists. Okay. He was a populist vote. So you had Republicans, you had Democrats, you had independents, but they wanted something that would make America great again. But to have a great America, you have to be competitive worldwide with some of these countries that can provide so much cheaper labor. Now, Trump, he may not admit this, but he needs a weaker dollar, does he not?
That certainly has been the stated objective. You're right. The U.S. populist following, they would, on the one hand, they'd benefit from perhaps higher paying manufacturing jobs if those did come back, onshoring, if that were to occur. But on the other hand, a weaker dollar may negate some of the benefits of a higher paying job by having the goods and services that we all have to pay for come in at a higher price. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, you've got Trump, you've got Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, who appear to have already set the course for a weaker dollar. The issue is, if they do, and that is the course we're on, we will not have foreign capital flows that support our deficit financing. And it comes back to that question of who is going to pay the U.S. debt? If it's not the central banks, if it's not our foreign creditors like the petrodollar recyclers of years gone past or the Chinese and the Japanese on a trade basis, who is going to finance our deficits? And if we're saying that a declining dollar is in play, in contrast to what we were arguing earlier, presenting earlier, it's not going to be foreigners. Foreigners don't step into a declining currency with glee. That's not good news for them.
Well, and if you're listening, like me, and your head is spinning, and you're like, oh my gosh, there are so many ramifications to both a weaker and a stronger dollar, deficits, spending, all this. This is really, if you want to simplify this program, you just call it between a rock and a hard place, right? I mean, because in a way, a stronger dollar has merits, and it has consequences, bad consequences, a weaker dollar, the same type of thing. Yet we are increasing our deficit, and we have to find someone to loan us the money. This is the problem that we're stating.
Yeah, you know, the weaker dollar, it impacts inflation trends. And I think it underscores interest rates moving higher as they have moved and are likely to move higher. It reinforces the outflows from U.S. equities. It reinforces something of a trend into the U.S. bond market for the U.S. investor.
Well, and what we're talking about here is economic. We're not talking about the financial markets. Now, one of the things that Trump criticized before he was elected was this bubble in the stock market. Yet, and I'm not trying to take a shot at Trump, but he started taking responsibility and credit for a rising stock market. That could really shoot him in the foot.
Huge tactical error. Huge tactical error on his part. He should have stuck with the economic improvement meme. He should have left the stock market performance out of the mix. If anything, he should have moderated expectations. Because in life, as in relationship, you understand that a part of your success deals with how you live into expectations or shape them or, you know, understand them and, you know, again, live into them.
Don't promise what you can't deliver.
Well, since the election, he's tweeted at least 58 times taking credit for the rise in the stock market, which implicitly will also credit him with a fall as well. Notice that he tweeted last week, he's like, I can't believe this. Economy's going great. We're doing everything that we can. Stock market's falling. That doesn't make any sense,
well,
does it?
What did he used to call it? He used to call it a big, fat, ugly bubble until he took over.
That's right. When he was in his campaign voice on the campaign trail, and he was saying, look at what Obama's done. He's taken funny money. And those were his literal words. He's created a big, fat, ugly bubble in the stock market. I think, you know, you step into the presidential Oval Office, pride gets the better of you, and now you own the bubble. And as long as it's going up, you're like, hey, this is because of me. Look at me. This is really impressive.
Yeah.
I think he should have stuck with the economy because financial markets are likely to be unkind to him, even though the economy is fine. Financial markets are likely to be unkind to him heading towards a reelection bid, even with the economic tailwinds helping him.
Well, and you talked about Russell Napier. And one of the things that Russell told us a few years ago was that we better get used to command and control dynamics. In other words, forced investing, forced monetary management, you know, the Rogoff cashless society. I noticed on Monday that China is now calling on companies, mutual funds, large investors to go in and buy their stocks. Do you think that there would be pressure from the White House or from the Federal Reserve on some of these larger passive management funds like Vanguard, okay, where there's pressure to go in and buy these treasuries and actually become the source for the funding of this deficit?
You know, you say calling on. It's a very small difference between being called on to do something and being mandated or it being legislated.
A la command control.
Yeah. Go back to the language that we used in 1968 when the French started taking gold out of Fort Knox. And we called on Friends of America to settle the liabilities in greenbacks, in paper currency, and not to take gold mm-hmm. out of Fort Knox. Now, of course, we weren't demanding that they stop. That happened in 1971 when we closed the gold window.
We just strongly suggested it if you ever want to have a favor from America again.
If you want to be in the friend category, yeah. And what's implicitly the other side of that? The enemy category. You choose what camp you want to be on, but please do as you're so inclined. Now, so there is a difference between, but not very much of a difference between being called on, mandating, and ultimately having it legislated. If you were the president, if you were the Treasury Secretary, under certain circumstances, who would you keep on speed dial? And again, I think this goes back to, you know, what's been popularized as the Plunge Protection Team, which is technically and officially known as the President's Working Group on Financial Markets. You need to make sure that you've got speed dial to your top 10 asset management
companies. Well, isn't there a huge concentration of a lot of assets just in a few companies?
Yeah. I mean, in the top 10 asset management companies in the U.S., you're talking about control of over $25 trillion, right? So BlackRock and Vanguard are both north of $5 trillion apiece. And that's a lot of jello that can be shifted around the plate. So you start thinking in terms of political pressure, regulatory pressure, antitrust pressure, any kind of legislative requirements for a more passive management behemoth. What if you need an allocation to favor treasuries?
Well, look at what happened a couple of years ago when you saw favor towards treasury money markets. They were allowed to set their share value at $1 a share. But if these money markets invested in anything else, they were not allowed to do that.
Right. It changed the risk metrics for the investor, and the investor was given the freedom of choice to move to someone that was investing in commercial paper,
right,
which gave him a higher return. But the buck could trade above or below a dollar value, net asset value, or treasury, which gave you the guarantee of a dollar return on your money.
Right.
You weren't taking risk in a money market fund as long as it was treasury backed.
Even though those treasuries fluctuate just like commercial paper do,
they
just showed favoritism.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So after all, it's somebody's savings that have to fund our deficit.
Yeah.
And so the question is, where does it come from? And this is why the whole conversation today, ping pong back and forth between dollar up or dollar down, is important. It's not as if we have a crystal ball, but if the dollar goes up, there's implications. And if the dollar goes down, there's implications, right? So you should watch the dollar. It's not foreign central banks any longer that are going to finance the U.S. deficit. It's not the U.S. Fed, at least as stated at present. So in sum, you've got Napier that argues that U.S. dollar strength, if we do witness that, will reveal global liquidity weakness. Keep that in mind. U.S. dollar strength will reveal global liquidity weakness, and that is very much like a replay of the 1997 emerging market crackups. We had Thailand, we had many of the Asian tigers hitting the skids. Ultimately, it rocked most of Asia and Russia. And you could tie that to too much U.S. dollar denominated debt and not enough liquidity. So there's a paradox between having debt as money. You have high quantities of money like assets, that is debt, but on the other hand, very little money to make payments on the debt when capital flows begin to shift.
Well, and again, that's only a problem when you're a deficit country. Back when we were on the gold standard, that wasn't a problem, because if you didn't have enough gold, you had to have it before you could pay your bills back. Now the question is, what's debt and what's money, or are they both the same?
So that's U.S. dollar strength. Then you move to the other hand. On the other hand, Napier argues U.S. dollar weakness, it creates a domestic funding issue where U.S. investors are likely to be the funders of our deficit. And that is resolved by a nasty bear market in stocks where you see a capital flow from stocks to bonds.
Well, with that being said, you said you're going to be writing an article in the McIlvaney Intelligence Advisor, your dad's newsletter, looking at these issues, saying, look, as far as gold's concerned, a weak dollar or a strong dollar, that's not really the question here, okay? And so, for the listener who wants to see that particular issue when it comes out, can we give that for free if they give us a call, Dave?
Absolutely. But, you know, it's worth noting that when you look at the political left going apoplectic about the quote-unquote breakdown of the liberal world order, these are the trends that are driving gold demand internationally. We are moving into a period of global chaos and disunity unlike any that we've had in the post-war era. Yes, so globalization brought us a great deal of benefits and blessings. Deglobalization, globalization in reverse. What we've talked about many times with Harold James, who wrote a book on that topic, where basically he argues that we are in fact moving into another era of deglobalization. So whether you like it or not, and I'm certainly no champion of global instability, we are sitting ringside here coming into 2018 and ultimately into 2019, one of those years which I think will be a banner year for gold. That means you've got to have your strategy lined out. Where do you go from here? If you don't own it now, should you own it? In what form? How are you processing those decisions, risk mitigation decisions today, and also planning an exit strategy? Because by the way, when gold reaches peaks, which I think could be over the next 3 to 5 years, you better have something of a reduction or exit strategy. If you're not mapping that out, you're missing a great opportunity.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. If you would like to see the McIlvaney Intelligence Advisor, the article that David's going to write in the next month, give us a call now. We'll put you on a list, and when it comes out, we'll send that to you for free. Our number here is 800-525-9556, and you can find us on McIlvaney at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.